Jon Stewart is back at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. Listen to The Daily Show Ears Edition on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Beyond the Scenes, the Daily Show podcast that goes deeper into topics and discussions and segments that originally aired on the Daily Show. Like, this is what you got to think of this podcast as. This podcast is like, you know, you go to church. You go to church, you can go to heaven. This podcast is them little sandwiches you get after church. Like, you know, you go to church and you praise the Lord, but then down there in the fellowship hall, they got them little finger sandwiches, and they got all them little peppermints that be in the bottom of a black lady's purse. That's what this podcast is. I think that analogy worked. This Black History Month, we are taking a look at a CP time I did not too long ago about the history of black superheroes. And we talked about some of the more notable superheroes in black history. Give me the clip. Black superheroes are not new. In fact, they've been squeezing into spandex for decades, dating as far back as 1936, when cartoonist Jay Jackson created Speed Jackson in the Chicago Defender newspaper. Speed Jackson was a former track star at Howard University who was an excellent fist fighter, which may not sound powerful compared to today's superheroes with their laser eyes and sticky spider hands, but you have to think about it like sports. Today's best athletes are the pinnacle of human physicality, while the best athletes from the 1930s were just the ones with the least polio. Times change. Jackson used his abilities to fight against fascists during the war and right the wrongs of a racist society, which is tough because superpowers don't help when you're fighting systemic racism. Doesn't matter if you have the strength of 10 men if none of those men can get a mortgage. To help me dive a little bit deeper into this topic, we got a lot of brothers. We're going to go around the horn here real quick. First up is a certified nerd and stand-up comedian and Daily Show writer, Super nerd, Ashton Womack.
What up, Roy?
Ashton Womack. I ain't trying to disrespect you, gangster.
No, I appreciate it.
You know, you still Houston. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Don't.
How many times have you been on this show? Like, what number is this again? Like, you have to, like...
I think this is, like, my fourth time.
Give or take.
Yeah.
Also joining us is a comic artist who creates narrative-driven work and incorporates his own character creations into his work, Hebrew Brantley. Hebrew, how you doing today?
What's up, Roy? I'm great, man. I'm glad to be on. So I appreciate you guys having me.
Well, appreciate you for being smart enough to not join us in this hot-ass studio. Nice and air-conditioned where you are. Television is torture, Hebrew. It's torture. Also, for the very first time, this man's work has helped make this podcast happen up until now. We have a senior producer and self-professed geek of all things, Aaron Lamar Burleson. Aaron, how you doing?
Testing 1, 2. Wow. This is how it feels like going beyond the scenes.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah,
I'm doing great, Roy. It's a pleasure and honor to be on the show with you all.
You're normally helping to produce all these segments and put all the wheels on the car so it can go vroom. But thank you for settling in on this one, because Ashton, we was like, yeah, we talk about black geeks. And Aaron was like, well, you know, I have a lot to say about this topic. I think I'll just write myself into the episode.
Yeah, I was like, you should be the episode. What are we here for?
So I'll go around the horn to the three of you first. I want to know when you first started reading comic books and becoming engrossed in the world of comic books, and when you recognize your first black comic superhero. Because I'm going to be honest, for me, I grew up with budget limitations. And so, you know, where I'm from, you could really choose one of two things. You could collect baseball cards or you could collect comic books. You could not afford both. And with a little bit of extra money I did have, I would spend that on video game magazines. Shout out to GamePro. Mm-hmm. Shout out to Electronic Gaming Monthly. Shout out to Nintendo Power. So
Game
I never...
Former.
Game Informer.
I was like, you speaking to my nerd heart right now.
So I never dealt with the comic books. And so there would be kids in middle school that had the comic books, but what I knew of comic books was the cartoons. If it didn't have a Saturday morning cartoon, I couldn't tell you anything about it. Knew nothing. But I could name you who was on the bench for the Cincinnati Reds in 1988. So
that's a different type of nerd. That's still in the, you're still in the house.
So but this is a world that I really do not have much of a, it does not connect to my childhood, if I'm just being 100. So I want y'all to walk me through how you all got connected into comic books. Ashton, I'll start with you. But how did you get into comic books, and what was the first like sense of representation that you saw?
I would say the way I got into comic books was I grew up on Fox. They had weekday afternoon cartoons. Yeah. You would watch X-Men. You would watch all the superhero cartoons. And that sparked my love for comic books. Now, the first superhero that actually got me truly loving superhero, it's always been black superheroes. My first superhero I loved was Meteor Man. Yeah, it's not a comic book. It's a movie.
Robert Townsend.
So many famous black actors. But when I was growing up as a kid, we would watch Meteor Man 18,000 times a day.
So then to that point, Aaron, what did you discover? Because Meteor Man, that's a movie, you know, and Ashton, you know, he kicking back with his pops watching something that probably was, that movie was a little grown. It's a classic. It was a little grown for your, you're like 5, 6 years old. What about you, Aaron? How'd you get into, like, where did you go to get them? Because, like, comic books was, that was a white side of town errand. And growing up, for me, growing up in Birmingham, you did not go to the white side of town unless a white classmate had a birthday or unless it was time to go Christmas shopping. Yeah. That was literally another universe.
Yeah.
So where are you even finding the comic books to buy? Like, who is your people? How did you get into this?
You know, I have to give a lot of credit for a lot of my, you know, geekdom and fandom to my older brother, Brian. You know, he was an avid collector. So he had a bunch of G.I. Joe comics. But it was when he was growing up and going away to, you know, college and everything, he let me inherit his comic book collection, which had a lot of the 1970s Batman comic books, you know what I mean? And that, you know, vintage blue and gray jumpsuit. And so you get a lot of those like 70s and 80s Batman comics, Death in the Family, where you see the second Robin passing away by the hands of the Joker. And so I was really fortunate to have an older brother who was into a lot of geek stuff, Star Wars, Batman, G.I. Joe. And so it was from inheriting his comics that I developed a joy and love. In addition, you know, Ashton, I as well was watching all those weekday cartoons in the afternoon, X-Men and Batman, the animated series. So really developed and coalesced through. I mean, I think the animated series for Batman is one of the groundbreaking series of all time. And so it was really in that pocket that I really embraced, you know, my geekdom in a way and grew to have such a love affair with this art form.
Now, Hebrew, you took it to another level because you started drawing and actually trying to do something with all this stuff, unlike these two shiftless Negroes. How did representation, you know, how did that inspire your work? Like, did you ever feel a moment and, you know, and Ash and Aaron, feel free to jump in on this as well. Was there ever a character where you're like, oh, damn, that's going to be my through line, or that's the one that inspired me to go to the next level with this?
Nah, man, you know, I'm probably a little older than, you know, the brothers on the panel. And I think for me, it was like, I came into it through my mom. My mom was just a reader. My mom would read everything, and she just wanted me to be a reader. And I wouldn't connect with anything, you know, like I would pick up something, start it and not finish. And then she introduced me to comic books, but it was her way. So it was like Archie and all that shit that excuse me, I don't know if I can curse.
No, you can curse.
Okay. Fine. Yeah. All right. But you know, the stuff that, again, it just was a little too white for me, you know, and wasn't funny. And then I gravitated more towards like X-Men and all that stuff. And I think that, like, you know, my first introduction before comics, or kind of maybe at the same time, to black heroes is a questionable black hero, which is Panthro from Thundercats.
Mm. Yes.
Yeah. So,
yes.
The Panthro, mechanic. They just always made him fix shit.
Exactly. That was it. And then he had nunchucks. You know what I mean? Right. Niggas love nunchucks. Yeah, let's just do that. And it was, you know, Panthro was voiced by the grandfather on the Cosby Show.
Oh, yes, yes.
No, that makes sense.
Yeah, and it was, so, you know, he had that deep black man, like, you know, I felt like it was my grandfather talking to me. So,
and that was his character in the show. He was, like, kind of voice of reason. He was the
Lion-O. Yeah, he's like, Lion-O, like, you being a pussy. Like, come on, stop now. Like, let's stop this shit. But in all sincerity, like, that was sort of my way in. And then it was like, you know, the 11-year-old boy in me saw Storm. And yes. That was like, oh, okay, this is speaking to me on a few levels, right?
It's okay, not just, now we're cooking, okay.
Right. But, you know, when it came to my stuff, I think, you know, it wasn't, I think it's just a combination of just like all these things that I've sort of ingested over the years, you know what I mean? Like these different heroes, different characters. But, you know, I think, man, we all were hooked on blonde-haired, blue-eyed supermen for the longest time, right? Because that's all we were fed.
Yeah, you know, the closest I came to comic books, I would read comic strips in the newspaper every day. I grew up in a newspaper house, so especially on Sundays, we passed the paper around the table, and you just read all the different sections. And so, you know, to that point, Hebrew, like, I'm trying to think, and, you know, Birmingham media, especially print media, is hella conservative back in those days. So I don't even think I saw the Boondocks until late 90s. But to me, the blackest thing I saw in the newspaper was the Phantom. And he was a vigilante, and he was tearing up shit.
Yeah, no, only reason why I thought he was black because he was in the jungles all the time. Yeah. I was like, he's a black superhero.
And then the movie came out, they had Billy Zane
playing. Billy Zane.
Shout out to Billy Zane.
I thought that was the original Black Panther for real.
Guess he ain't black at all.
It was such a lack of black characters out there. I had to identify with Beast from the X-Men because he was blue at least. And so someone that you can still see yourself in because... You couldn't really see yourself in Cyclops. You couldn't really, even though you have Wolverine and he was dope, you couldn't see yourself in that. So at least with Beast being blue, you can still kind of see it a little bit. It's not till you get Bishop coming to the X-Men 2, where Bishop is just a strong, like 6'6" black guy with like wavy jet black hair. And just
now, call it what it is. Bishop had a Jerry curl.
He had a Jerry curl.
Curl.
Bishop looked like he was a running back for the Ravens. Defensive lineman.
But how did that make you feel, Hebrew and Ashton? Like when you saw a brother that looked like your uncle from a family barbecue. You in a comic book, because I remember seeing, for me, it was Bo Jackson, Frank Thomas, Ken Griffey Jr. Those were the three black athletes that made me feel like, oh, he's doing, especially Bo, because he's from around the corner in the Birmingham suburb. So like, I remember that feeling of, man, I can do this because he looks like me. Was that your character, Aaron? Was Jerry Curl, man?
Bishop was that. I mean, because at that point, you're really grasping for some sort of representation. So you get that with Bishop, right? You have a person who's not from the time period that the X-Men are taking place in. He's from a dystopian future. And he's coming back to right the wrongs that kind of led way to his horrible future, you know, where he is inhabiting. So... But Bishop was a little bit off his rocker, you know what I mean? But it was okay because he was really cool and militaristic in a way. So I really gravitated to that.
Hebrew, I'll start with you on this question. Do you think that black cartoons outside the mainstream get enough credit or get enough attention? You know, like within the mainstream culture, how much do black cartoons get their props from the mainstreams the way that they deserve? Is the tide changing-ish a little bit, or is it still kind of pick and choose?
I think it's pick and choose, man. Like, I don't know any, I mean, besides like Boondocks, obviously that had a real moment, right? And it still does. I think it kind of reverberates, you know, when you get people, you know, sort of reposting memes and things like that and how it sort of lived through. But
you talking overall, the strip or the cartoon or both?
Well, really both. TV show. More so the TV show, because that's what everybody, you know, like that's where a lot of people found it. You know what I mean? Yeah. And so I think beyond that, man, there really hasn't been. Like, we've only just been sidekicks, you know, to the white characters. And I'm not, you know, it's just... You know, we get a Proud Family every now and then. You know, we have little blips on the map.
There's a reboot, I think, coming.
There is. It's here. It's out. Yeah.
It's out. Okay. It's really fun. It's really good.
And it's good. But again, like, we don't, you know, I feel like it's the quota situation. It happens in Hollywood all the time. I mean, a few years ago, you know, when Hollywood found out that, you know, black was cool. Again, after Black Panther.
Was profitable.
There you go. Black, yeah, exactly. We can make money off these folks. You know, it was just that thing of like, let's retrofit this character who was probably a white man. Let's make him black. But they don't really change anything except for just, you know, replacing the actor or the person, not necessarily reforming the character. And I feel like that happens in cartoons and animation all the time, where it's just like, you know, we have to feel, all right, we have, how many black kids do we have in this group? What? Oh, shit. You know, let's get a black kid in here real quick.
Give him some pink hair.
Right.
I mean, have y'all seen the new Velma TV show?
No, I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah. Where Shaggy's black.
Shaggy's
black.
It ain't just Shaggy.
Shaggy's black. He don't smoke weed. He don't even get high. Yeah. I don't even know what kind of Shaggy that is. You know,
this is not Shaggy. When it comes to like what you're talking about, where they reskin white characters for put a black face on white characters. Mm. We need representation, but that it's the other side of that. It's like, yeah, I like Shaggy. I've been watching Scooby-Doo.
You know what's wild about that too is that it's one of the things I feel like white people and black people both agree on. Because black people want their own stories, and white people don't want to see their favorite characters, you know, dipped in chocolate.
Like,
like, I agree.
They're like, well, listen, you say that, and then you'd be like, hey, you know, Jesus, that guy might have been, he might have started off.
The original superhero.
Yeah.
But then you even take something like, say, Miles Morales Hebrew, where you have Spider-Man Into the Spideyverse, right? Which was an animated film with a black Spider-Man who, you know, a whole Spider-Verse or whatever. And it did so well, there was rumblings for a quick minute. Oh, I bet they should do a live action Miles Morales. And then it was like, nah, we're just gonna give y'all a sequel of this one more time.
But I feel like that, you know, again, with that, listen, I Miles is one of my favorite characters in comics. And I, you know, I love the character. Although they've never really given him to, you know, a decent black writer or group of black creators, which they should have. But, you know, with that movie, I think that movie worked because it was just a good movie, right? Yeah. Like they really honed in on making Miles feel authentic. His neighborhood felt authentic. His parents' shit feels like Miles' last name is Morales. And his dad's last name, what's his dad's last name, Aaron?
Davis,
right? Like, that's some real shit. You know what I mean? Like, that's not even his daddy.
My last name, Womack. My dad's last name, Lomax. They just happen to rhyme. They not the same.
So I think they did a good job in bringing in some authenticity. I think that we will start to see more of that. But, you know, again, it's like where, you know, Hollywood's motivated by the dollars. And as long as, you know, Peter Parker, like, we'll get the black Miles in real time at one point, but you know, white Spider-Man is still, you know, very, very bankable. So
well, after the break, I want to talk to you a little bit more. I want to talk to all of you actually about how we can introduce new black characters, new black IP into the world of comic books and eventually matriculating into television and profitable movie franchises for you Hebrew. But also the hurdles that you've dealt with in trying to break through new concepts and what that world is like. This is Beyond the Scenes. We'll be right back.
Jon Stewart is back in the host chair at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. You get hilarious, satirical takes on entertainment, politics, sports, and more from Jon and the team of correspondents and contributors. The podcast also has content you can't get anywhere else, like extended interviews and a roundup of the weekly headlines. Listen to The Daily Show Ears Edition on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Beyond the Scenes, we are back. We are talking the world of black superheroes and why we only get the same couple of superheroes remix, even though we got a whole universe of black stories waiting in the queue to be told. One of our guests has been creating some of these characters. Now, Hebrew, walk us through this journey, because I want to talk a little bit this break just about a lot of the existing black movie IP and how it came to actual fruition. But I want to talk with you first just from the ideation of drawing a character, creating the character, creating a comic around the character. Walk us through that journey of what that was like. Because are you creating a character like with television, like Ashton, I know you know this, like with television, the trick is, do you want to write and create a character that you know everybody will gravitate towards, that they'll like, or are you writing what you like? and then you making people get on board with what you're into?
Well, I think for me, my journey is real unique in the way that I didn't start out trying to create a comic or anything like that. I come from the world of high art, right? So like, you know, paintings for galleries, museums, etc. And in doing that over the years and trying to find my voice, I kind of accidentally landed on this idea. A lot of the work that I was doing early in my career, it had a lot of angst to it. You know, it was very pro-Black, or maybe a little bit too much, you know, skewed a little too dark or heavy-handed, so to speak. And I think, you know, within the gallery world in that space, you kind of have to, you know, you have to walk a line. You know, there's mm-hmm. you have to be very clever about how you say certain things. And so for me, it was like, you know, the advice that I got from a lot of my peers was like, man, you know, you have to paint things that you know, that you're familiar with, the things that feel like you. And for me growing up, you know, a self-professed sort of Black nerd on comics, cartoons, anime, all that shit, trying to really figure out what that was. And it wasn't until, you know, a few years after college where I had found myself in that place that we all do, where it's like, man, what's the next thing? And, you know, I found a book on World War II, just was thumbing through it and landed on the Tuskegee Airmen. And with Tuskegee Airmen, you know, it was like a lightning bolt that hit me, because it was like, man, nobody has really touched on these brothers from the standpoint of like, their journey was so powerful. It struck me in this way because the time in which they existed, the time in which they were charged with doing certain things, our world was a mess. I mean, it's not that different from where it is now, but we're talking world war. We're talking, you know, within America, Blacks are, you know, treated significantly less than, right? But then they're allowed and tasked to fly these planes, and they do it successfully, and these brothers are buttoned up, and, you know, they are the sort of personification of what manhood is, right? And what heroism is. And so I found that, and I just thought about, like, man, like, what if there was like this character or these characters that existed that time just kind of forgot about, right? Like, it happens all the time. These cartoons that fall off the shelf and never get seen. And so I created Flyboy, which became sort of my staple IP, but as kind of a lark, like within the high art space of just like creating this show, like presupposing that I found this animation project that never saw the light of day. And I presented it like that to my audience. And
like some found footage.
Yeah. So it was kind of, you know, just bringing people in that way, because I felt like that was the easiest way than just to say, you know, hey, I created this thing whole cloth, check this out. And people started to bite, you know, folks come into the show, the response was great, but it wasn't just a response to, like, you know, because there was no narrative behind it, for real. Like, there was no story through line or anything like that, but people started
gravitating. So you didn't present him as a Tuskegee Airman. Did you present him as Black, or was he just all goggled up and scarfed up?
Goggled, blackface, little kid, mm-hmm. you know, with or without superpowers. Take it how, you know, take it what you will. But I think that people were allowed to read into it. And I think that there was sort of like this message behind it of empowerment that people really, you know, they felt. And so, as I started doing more and more shows, the expectation for more and more of these paintings, you know, grew, and people were coming to the shows looking for Flyboy. I had people making, you know, mm-hmm. like little Halloween costumes, just, you know, cheap little aviator goggles, red scarves, etc. And so it just grew into a thing where, you know, it wasn't intended to be, you know, a thing that I continued on with. It was intended to just be this moment, but as it started to grow and my understanding of it started to grow, I started to attach narrative to it, because, you know, nobody knew the origins, or they weren't coming for that. They were just coming for the aesthetics and the messaging behind it. And so, you know, a few years back, I finally, you know, created a comic. You know, it was my first run. And, you know, like any junior, you know, novice to a thing, I pretty much wrote myself into a corner by issue two. I killed off one of the main characters by issue two, and I was like, oh shit. So I kind of had to, like, you know, wheel it back, but like let those things exist on an island by themselves, and then sort of retool and recreate something. But again, all that to say that, you know, it wasn't me intending to make something, to make this what it's become. It was sort of a happy accident. But, you know, again, through that has bared, you know, a lot of really, really, really strong fruit.
Okay, so then you create Flyboy, and then you're eventually going to be at a crossroads, if you aren't already, that a lot of Black content creators are going to be at now, where you have an idea, and the trade-off for exposure and money is new cooks get to come in the kitchen and tinker with the seasoning on this dish that you've perfected up until this point. How difficult is it to try and navigate deciding on how to hold on to your IP as things start to grow? Because when we talk about this idea that there's this backlog of all of these Black ideas and Black comic strip shows that are out there that deserve to be seen and deserve to be made into movies, but how much of it is the studios and the labels and the distribution networks creating an impossible contract that you just possibly can't agree to? And is that one of the hurdles that is keeping something like, say, Flyboy from truly expanding to something even greater?
From flying, if you will.
To soaring. How difficult is it to try and keep control of your IP? Because you're trying to grow this shit.
Yeah.
But then to grow it, you got to give it to somebody that gets to go, I do whatever I want, and we can make Flyboy and give him a sister, and Flyboy can tell him, let's make him 34. Flyman.
No, I mean, it's a task, but I think for me, again, my situation is unique in the sense that, like, this isn't a comic book, right, that you're selling for $5, right? These are paintings that sell for, you know, thousands of dollars, right?
You got to take your prices. Don't tell them your prices.
Collectibles.
You know, you got to hit them up offline.
A lot of dollars. But, you know, these are collectibles that I've created and statues that I've created that, you know, are now seen all around the world. These are collectibles that, you know, go on eBay for triple the price. You know, you're talking $4,000 or $5,000 for some plastic, you know, figurines. And with that, you know, it kind of changes my narrative when coming into Hollywood, because it's like the product is proven. And, you know, I'm only doing this on a smaller level when it comes to, you know, I'm keeping it contained at a very limited number. But, you know, it's proven. Look, these are the numbers here. And this is just me doing it. So, you know, if we start to bring this thing out to the masses, you know, it's going to obviously change, and you're going to, you know, get more eyes around it, gain more fandom around it. And, you know, obviously, you know, it's able to grow, the IP grows, et cetera. But just me being able to do it on my own is already, I think, a lot more than most are able to kind of come in the game with. Like, most folks are coming in with the idea, if it's a book or if it's a script, you know, that's not as leverageable as, you know, building out a world, doing, you know, exhibitions. I did an experiential exhibition in Chicago a few years ago called Nevermore Park, where basically I created the world of Flyboy, and you kind of walk through in this experience, basically through an origin story of this character, right? And you know, we had a couple hundred thousand visitors to it. I bought like 50,000 tickets for CPS students, so they were able to kind of come through. You know, it really expanded you know, our fan base in a lot of ways, and also showed them sort of another side, because they're only familiar with the paintings. And, you know, again, having had all of that gives me a little bit more leverage in those conversations with different studios.
Ashton Aaron, why don't studios accept the fact that Black superhero hit movies are not an anomaly? It irks me that the first Iron Man is credited with being the beginning of the Marvel
cinematic
rise.
Yeah, universe, yeah.
It irks me when we all know the truth is that it was Blade.
We do.
Now, they didn't connect Blade to none of the other shit, and maybe that's why they try not to write it off. Blade had a budget of about 40, 45 million, if I'm not mistaken. Grossed about 100. Yeah. It made about 100. It did 130. It did about 130, 140. It made its money back, and then another 100 million.
Yeah.
give
enough
or take.
To justify a sequel, right? Two sequels.
Yeah, it got sequels and a TV series, which Spike canceled because they said they couldn't afford the special effects. That's a true story. So why don't these films, like, why, like, let's just talk about the erasure of Blade.
Yeah.
Is there, do you even agree with that point, Aaron? Let's just start there.
Oh, like, absolutely.
Do you think there's been a degree of-
I mean, we can go a step further, just talk about the erasure of Wesley Snipes, but I think.
Well, he would have paid his taxes.
That was 3 years.
We're talking about Blade 4, 5, 6.
Yeah. I mean.
Well, you know, him and Ryan Reynolds didn't get along in that era when they tried to play Wesley as a diva.
But the thing about
it. I heard that story.
Yeah, it was a lot of commotion, apparently, with that Blade Trinity production, but we have to take it back to the 1990s and understand that before Blade the film, there isn't a successful Marvel film adaptation at that point. You have the Captain America film, which is from the 1990s, which is, it's not what we have with Chris Evans now. And then Dolph Lundgren Punisher, cult classic, but not a hit by any means. And then you have this buried Roger Corman Fantastic Four film that wasn't even released to the general public, and you can only find copies of it at Comic-Con. And so Marvel was doing this thing of licensing out their characters, not building an overall universe, but licensing them out to 20th Century Fox, licensing them out to Columbia Pictures, Sony, and just seeing what it got. It wasn't as much of a creative powerhouse in the film game as it is today. And so you get this film called Blade, which is rated R, which is bloody, violent, vampire flick, action flick, and it literally... It becomes a hit. It becomes a hit because of the performance of Blade, because of this representation of this black superhero. But it also creates a door for us to get X-Men in 2000, for us to get Spider-Man in 2002 and all the various films that come and kind of give us modern contemporary visual adaptations of superheroes on film. And so I just think it's just one of those things where people don't want to give black characters or black actors or performers the credit. And it's old-fashioned racism. Yeah. They're trying to, you know, qualify with different metrics and whatnot, but Blade was a hit to generate two more films in a film in a series adaptation. But again, they want something more.
But at no point did they go, what are some of the mother black characters we got in the vault? Like, why didn't Marvel go digging the crates?
Yeah.
Because a lot of those characters are whack as hell. Let's be real.
Black Panther, think about one of the hurdles they had to overcome with Black Panther was M'Baku's character. He was just a racist gorilla in the comic books. Right. He was just straight up a gorilla, a monkey. That was his power, Monkey Man or something like that. Mm-hmm. And they had to make him a modern character for today and get rid of the racist trope that he was. So I'm sure they go and look through their list of black characters, and half of them are just stereotypes.
Even with Black Panther, you know, was a character that was created by Jack Kirby. Rest in peace, Jack Kirby, one of the greatest comic book creators of all time. But you know, Jack Kirby's not a brother, and I'm pretty sure, like, I don't think Jack had many brothers on his Rolodex. Like, hey, man, I'm creating this character called the Black Panther.
Can I run it by you for notes?
Right, let me get these notes involved. Also, hold on, can I just shout this out? This is a very, very proud moment in my life of nerddom. But my paintings and my figures were in Wakanda Forever.
That's hard.
And
shout out to that.
It was like the biggest nerd moment. I it was all quiet in the theater, and I saw my shit, and I just let it. Oh,
that's fire! You be like, yo, this movie the greatest movie in the world. I don't know. I love this movie.
All right, then let's stay on that detour for a second. Then, how do you get that call? Do you get a call from like secret number unknown? And then, hello, hey,
is it Samuel L. Jackson with an eye patch and shield? He's recruiting.
You get a phone call. How you doing, brother? It's Ryan Coogler.
It has to be Nate Moore or somebody. Moore. I know
Ryan through Mike. Right. So I got a chance to hang out on the first Black Panther set.
Michael B. Jordan. Ago.
Yeah, Mike B. Jordan. Okay. Sorry.
Just Mike. I know. That was wild.
I'm sorry. That was horrible.
I was like, Michael Jordan? You know Michael Jordan.
I was like, do I know Mike? Is this somebody I know? Is this a Mike we all know?
Oh, man.
Of B. Jordan fame. Okay, yes. Got you.
Of the B. Jordans. And so, you know, I was able to kind of go, you know, that route. But again, the space that I kind of maneuver in terms of, like, you know, black visual artists, you know, on the painting and sculpting side, and again, wearing multiple hats, I'm one of few. So I think that, you know, that kind of helps me maneuver and get to know some of these folks. And I saw Ryan Coogler in Atlanta when he first was coming back to start Black Panther 2. We ran into each other at the hotel, and I was trying to juice him for, you know, some gossip. I needed to know what was going to happen.
Yeah, give me some script line, storyline.
Give me something. Yeah. Of course, he didn't give me shit, but it was cool. But I think that, like, I would like to think that, you know, as Ryan is sculpting this, and this is so, you know, Black Panther is so cultural, right? It's not just about Wakanda, but like when you look at even Wakanda Forever, like there's lines about Fenty Beauty in there. There's, you know, it's Black culture. It's not just this fake African culture. And so I think that, you know, they do such a good job of being fully immersive and aware of what's going on, you know, outside in this world that they bring into this Marvel world to make it feel real for us. And I think that, you know, the character Riri being from Chicago, me being sort of, you know, Chicago's, you know, some of my characters sort of being the mascots in certain instances for Chicago. I think that it was just, you know, it was one of those things that just really worked. And I'll be honest with you, and this is going to sound like a flex, but, you know, it takes so long to make these movies that I forgot they even asked to use it, because it was like 4 years ago.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
That's true.
So, you know, it was like when I watched the movie, you're in the movie, and then I see my shit on her desk in the workshop, and then I see my shit on the wall, and I'm like, oh my God.
Me and you different. You show me something I did 4 years ago, I'm gonna be like, I'm gonna need that. I'm gonna need a cease and desist. I need that taken down. I need all that removed.
After the break, I want to bring it home and talk about how we can expand Black storytelling, you know, not only in comic books, but as it gets into television, and what do you think could happen and what you think probably won't happen? I got a question for all three of you after the break. This is Beyond the Scenes.
Jon Stewart is back in the host chair at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. You get hilarious, satirical takes on entertainment, politics, sports, and more from Jon and the team of correspondents and contributors. The podcast also has content you can't get anywhere else, like extended interviews and a roundup of the weekly headlines. Listen to The Daily Show Ears Edition on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Beyond the Scenes, this has been a wonderful, wonderful conversation about Black comic books and Black superheroes, and, you know, whether we can get a couple more on the screen that aren't remixed versions of old 1942 stereotype. I'm going to write me a Black superhero. It's going to be called Jive Turkey, you dig? And every time he kills somebody, he go, you dig?
I like that. I
you tell me, I bet you that shit get greenlit by
that's what I'm saying.
Now, I'll never be able to go back home to Birmingham again.
Or will you be a hero in Birmingham?
I can't go to Essence Fest after you write a movie called Jive Turkey. You dig?
Yeah. Oh, I got another idea. It's like Teen Titans, but they're called the Young Bloods.
Okay.
How honest can the Black experience be infused into Black superhero narratives? Do you think there is still space for expansion, Ashton?
I mean, I know there's space for expansion.
Will it get made, though?
I mean, it's up to us. It's up to us. We can't let white media or American media control the stories that we tell. I feel like one of my inspirations is Toni Morrison. I'm pretty sure she was like, I tell stories, I don't exclude Black people. I exclude white people. I tell stories from a Black experience, and they're for Black people. That's the kind of superhero story I want to see. A story that's truly all around, made for Black people. It involves every aspect of Black culture, and it does not have to capitulate to modern mainstream America, modern society. Why is it always Black stories that have to reach across the aisle so everybody else can feel seen and accepted? We ain't never been, nobody reach across the aisle for us. Why can't I tell
because
a story that's...
It revolves around the dollar. I think for me, being able to spend a little time in, you know, Hollywood and having all these conversations, right? Like, you know, studios are I mean, you know, these cats, they're not original, and it's the dollar is the bottom line. So I'm going to reach back in a catalog of things that we've done already that people are familiar with because once upon a time it lived, and we're going to redo that to death. And then we ain't got nothing else, right? Hopefully we have our Ryan Cooglers or our, you know, our Jordan Peels. Those are the only brothers that are, would be allowed to introduce something new at this moment, right?
Like with a little bit of radicalness to it.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Approved,
right.
State approved radical.
Maybe because Ava DuVernay. Ava DuVernay might, maybe. Mm-hmm. She might get in there.
I think so. I mean, but yeah, and yeah, not to exclude Ava at all. I think she's absolutely one of those ones. Yeah. But, you know, it's going to take someone of that ilk to get that thing across. I think, like, you look at the time in the 90s, you talked about, somebody mentioned, you know, Meteor Man, right? Like, Meteor Man doesn't get made even as a comedy if Robert Townsend doesn't have all that goodwill that he's built up.
Five Heartbeats.
Hollywood Shuffle.
Hollywood Shuffle.
Right?
I'm going to get you
some. Hollywood Shuffle is what got him to Meteor
Man. And those relationships. Yeah. Those relationships that he's built with all these phenomenal black comedians and talent where he can get, you know, get those folks in at a price so he can make his movie at a price. Right. And again, it still kind of had to be, you know, it's not to down Meteor Man because I love Meteor Man, but it had to be a comedy.
Yeah.
Right. It had to be a comedy. And it definitely plays on those 90s tropes of like the bad neighborhood and the gangs, the Golden Lords, right?
Like, Don Cheadle. Right.
Where you going? Give me your purse, old bitch.
and unfortunately, the thing about Meteor Man, it was a box office flop, right? And so when that crazy. Happens, Robert Townsend goes into Hollywood jail, can't direct for a little bit, or has to go make The Parenthood on television, which is a great series as well. But also, you don't really get that Meteor Man 2. And so, you know, and I think we kind of overlooked the importance of Black Panther being that it was Marvel's, I think it was Marvel's either 18th or 19th film at that point. And it was the first ever Marvel film to be nominated for Best Picture. And so just Marvel
outgrossed everything that came before it.
You know, and again, that's a one part in a series of these episodic films that people are just, okay, we're doing this film to get to the next point. But Black Panther was a cultural moment. It was a phenomenon. It was a phenomenon, really. And then Marvel was like, hey, so look at that. Look at what we did. And so it's kind of like, you know, you get those hits, but to try to get to that level and to maintain that, I feel there's way more pressure on Black creators. There's way more of a, see, we told you that it wouldn't sell. And then that opportunity gets yanked away when so many other folks in Hollywood can take swings and miss, but still be able to make other films. And so I think the playing field for us is very limited. And so you got to either get up and hit a home run, or you might not get that chance, honestly.
One of those challenges, though, Aaron, to what you're saying, even when you're talking about Meteor Man, is that, you know, we haven't, we as Black folks and folks of color, by and large, haven't been taught or haven't been welcomed into the conversation of science fiction.
Yeah.
Right. And so, you know, if this hero is playing in theaters 1 through 9, and Tyler Perry is playing in theater 10. Listen, I mean, seriously, like I'm off the streets with my lady. I'm going on a date. I'm not speaking just with myself, but I'm gonna go with Tyler Perry. That's a brand name for me. And it's something relatable, right? I think that, like, you know, the fact that categorically we have not been put into science fiction films in that narrative forever. Like we'd always be one of us, right? Like, you know, Billy Dee Williams was the only nigga in space for how long? Right?
Yeah.
And when they finally let LeVar Burton in space, he was blind.
He was blind, right? He had
Star Trek Next
Generation. He had on some shades.
Shout out to LeVar Burton, friend of the show.
Shout out to LeVar Burton, man.
So to the creators, to the Black content creators and writers that are listening to us, Hebrew, how do you allow your work to be the truest version of yourself? Like, you have a coffee table book that you've just put together that's now for sale at it's right there. Look at that. I can already tell from the cover of that book, Ashton, that's one of the books you put on the table and impress women.
It could be the only thing on the table too.
Next to a glazed candle. I don't know nothing about candles. As you look back at all of the work that you've done, enough to put into a book, which is already a crazy accomplishment to think about, that you've done enough that you went, you know what? And I know that's not even everything you've done. That's just the hits. How did you allow your art to be the truest version of yourself and not be influenced by what they might buy or what could? How did you stay true to what you wanted to do versus what you thought people wanted to see?
I think my art has sort of always been a bit of like my own diary, right? My art always reflects where I'm at, you know, emotionally, mentally. And so I think that, like, you know, with art starting out, there was not really a big risk. You know, you just do a thing. I'm working, I got two other jobs over here making, you know, horrible money, being a horrible employee, but it wasn't a risk to just go make some shit at night and paint and stay up all night and create some stuff. So I think that, like, starting out from an honest place of just like, I just need to express myself, you know, it's an easier upstart than, you know, I didn't have to start out from a place of like, I have to make things in order to pay the bills to survive. So I have to work according to everybody else's sort of level or expectation of what is good and what's cool. The thing that stuck with me a long time ago was Mos Def said, I just always wanted to grow up and make cool shit. And it's a very simple statement, but that's sort of how I lived, in that sense of like, if I can always be honest with myself and in my work, I'll be okay. No matter what other work I have to do, like, I have my outlet, and my outlet has now become my career and my occupation. So, you know, just one of those things that really kind of worked out. I'm lucky.
How, and I'll end with this question to all of you. And we've already kind of talked about whether or not we think that there'll be more Black superhero stories. I think that there will. I think, you know, whether or not they will be able to touch on all of the different intricacies that is the Black experience across the diaspora, you know, that's dependent on the producer and the level of trust the studio has in that director, blah, blah, blah. But once these fucking shows are on the air, do you think they'll give him time to find an audience? God damn. So there was a great show on CW called Naomi. It was about a Black girl, teenager, early teen, middle school.
Ava produced it, yeah.
Correct. And then Michael B. Jordan, Mike. He EP'd a show on Netflix, Raising Dion.
Dion,
which was about a single mom raising a Black boy with superpowers and how you navigate single mother, single parent with superpowers. Like, being able to turn the genre on its head a little bit, but neither one of those shows. Naomi got a season. I think Raising Dion got two from Netflix, if I'm not mistaken. So how do we get these places to still just give shows time to find their audience? Or is that just strictly money and we're screwed?
I think that's just the old days, man. This is all of the numbers game, you know, financial and you know, viewership. I think it's just, there's so many people buying for those spots and those slots, and you know, the turnaround is just a lot faster these days, where it's not networked, so they don't have to invest so much time and energy into you know, look at Seinfeld, man. How many seasons did it take for Seinfeld to actually pick up?
Two, maybe three.
Yeah.
Right.
He would have been canceled. He would have been canceled in the present day. That's my fear for the story of the Black superhero, is that even if these stories and the diverseness and the difference of all of the types of stories you want to tell, even if all that gets greenlit, once you're out there and you're on the playing field, are you going to get the support? Are you going to get the advertising? And are you going to be given the runway you need to actually find it? Like, if the CW won't give you a chance,
ain't nobody.
Home of Black Lightning and all those.
You're going to Tubi and that's it.
CW is like, get out of here, Ava. We got to put on another season of Flash.
Listen, we got to leverage our white allies' privilege. Taylor Swift, if you listen to this, I know what you did for Ticketmaster.
Yes.
Do that for Raising Dion season 3.
Yeah, bring it back. But I think you speak to a really important point of like, there's a pressure for the artists to create that will have a long-lasting effect and have success. And that's a hard place to come from an artist. Like Hebrew mentioned, he, you know, just created. You know what I mean? He was free to create. He wasn't caring about if this character IP that he created would one day, you know, connect with a larger, he was just doing him. And so I think more initiatives and programs for up and coming Black voices and artists, like the Milestone Initiative for Black Creatives from Milestone Comics. And I mean, we've already went so much time without even bringing up Milestone Comics, which is basically, like formed by Black creators, with Black characters, more of an authentic voice. And so they actually developed not too long ago a pipeline program for aspiring Black creatives who want to, you know, create comic book heroes and superheroes and play in that world. And so, again, like, no one can forecast the future, especially when it comes to media in particular. But what we can do is just develop, you know, opportunities to identify and spotlight some of those up and coming voices who can give us the next Static Shock, who can give us the next, you know, Icon or, you know, Rocket, someone like that who were featured in Milestone Comics that gave nuanced portrayals of Blackness in comic books, right? Like, they gave us not just this binary approach to life for Black people, but so much more. It gave us that world building aspect that you find a lot with Hebrew's character Flyboy. You know, it's not just one character, it's a whole world of experiences that we're looking to build. And so if we can develop more programs like that and identify more up and coming voices, I think that's a start. But like you said, you know, who knows when it comes to television and film? I mean, the bottom line is the dollar, and so we're always going to be fighting that.
Well, I think that's as good a place to end. And also, CW, I forgot that you gave us a lot of seasons of Black Lightning. I'm sorry for raising my voice. With that aside, thank you so much, Ashton.
Thank you, brother.
Aaron, Hebrew, much respect to you. We look forward to seeing your work in Black Panther Part 3. And I have my lawyers reach out to you. We want some of your work in my movie, Jive Turkey.
Let's get it.
Jive Turkey, let's go. Don't mess around. Turkey. Hebrew might have a proof of concept right now.
I'm trying to write myself in as a sidekick. So Youngblood could be a team of people or one person. I'll be.
And where can we get the book, Hebrew? Where can people order the book?
Your local bookstore, preferably. You know, people, they still exist, folks. Please patronize, you know, mom and pop bookshops. But other than that, the bald white man spot, Mr. Bezos, you can go to Amazon and pick one up right there, delivered right to you.
You know, there's so many weird names of businesses in New York that I thought that was a real business. had to say that. All right.
Oh, man. This is a great discussion. That's all the time we have for today. Thank you all so much for going behind the scenes with us. Give me some theme music. Listen to The Daily Show Beyond the Scenes on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Jon Stewart is back at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. Listen to The Daily Show Ears Edition on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.